Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As everyone knows by now, last November's election in North Carolina's 9th Congressional District was thrown out by the state's election board over allegations of election fraud. The board called for a new election, as did the winner in that first election, Mark Harris. However, he declined to run again, while his opponent, Democrat Dan McCready, who lost by a hair, is participating. This time, the Republican candidate in this special election is State Senator Dan Bishop. This hour, we hear from both candidates, beginning with Senator Bishop, who, because of his schedule, has elected to join us first because he has to leave first. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure being with you.
Nice to have you here. Did you consider running for this position when before Mark Harris decided to run the last time?
I did not. I've been content to serve this community in the General Assembly. I've done that in the House for a term and then the State Senate for this is my second term. And this was not on my horizon.
So why now?
Well, all the developments that you just made reference to in your lead happened. And when that finally occurred, when Mark Harris said he was not going to be the candidate in the rerunning of that race, I looked around and I thought it was important that someone who represent the values of the district and be able to mount an appropriate campaign should step forward.
Mark Harris won that race by about 905 votes. It was a really tight squeaker. Do you think you can better that margin of victory, considering that your opponent has been running for 27 months?
That was one of the challenges from the outset and continues to be a challenge. He has an enormous advantage by virtue of the time that he's been in the race, 27 or 28 months. He's raised and spent $12 million, a ton of it from outside North Carolina and outside the district. There's been outside spending beyond that in the terms of several million dollars. And he was sort of able to stow up money while we had a primary.
And yet it's very close because according to Inside Elections, it's a poll conducted by that organization, on August 26th, there was a 46-42 race. He has 46%, you have 42. So it's tied. It's within the margin of error. That means no matter which of you wins, you'll be representing half of the number of people who did not vote for you.
Right.
All right?
I suppose that you could say this.
So do you intend to serve that half, the half that didn't vote to you, or play to those who did, and if so, how?
Well, I think—
because they're two very different constituencies.
Yeah. In these times, Mike, I think we are a divided people. I mean, there's a lot of sharp division in politics, and might as well not deny it, I think. So someone's going to win a close election. I do think we all have a challenge and an aspiration. We should have an aspiration to govern with dignity, and that involves reaching out to and engaging with people who are willing to do so on a civil basis,
right,
who don't necessarily agree with all of your priorities and objectives.
You're hearing State Senator Dan Bishop, who's running for Congress in the 9th Congressional District. You are among the most conservative and the most, by your own description on your website, among the most effective lawmakers in North Carolina and in the State Senate. So why put that influence at risk to do this?
I've been asked that question. That is to say, some say Washington is so bound and mired in controversy and deadlock that you can do more good in the General Assembly. It is nonetheless an extraordinarily important thing, and what we do in our nation's decision-making and our Congress and executive branch and so forth, and I don't believe we can give up on it. The country's worth fighting for.
Your conservative bona fides, if I can use that ridiculous word, are underlined by your authoring of the famous, infamous HB2 legislation in the legislature, which was in direct response to this city's passing of an ordinance that allowed transgendered people to use the bathrooms of the gender with which they identify, and that resulted in the cancellation of major events, great division in the state and around the country, canceled events. We lost money in the deal, bad publicity for the state. Is this the kind of legislation that you'd like to push through Congress?
No. And I think if you look at my legislative career, it's not media is certainly fascinated with it continues to be fascinated with it, really beyond. I mean, if you look back at the debate I just had with Dan McCready, it didn't come up once.
I thought that was very odd.
That may be a question of perspective, mm-hmm. but I do think media is fascinated by it. But shouldn't we?
Politicians like to throw things that don't look good on them back to the media. Is that a fair thing to do?
Well, the media
only talked about it because it was in the news. It's the news.
Media makes news. Media, particularly today, media almost universally serves as a handmaiden to the far left. Certainly McClatchy's not neutral. With all due respect, Mike, you're not neutral. WFAE's not neutral, not in middle of the road objective. That's gone out the window.
How can you say that?
I think it's a perspective that's widely shared.
It's widely shared doesn't make it true.
Well, I think it is true. I mean, and we could go down the road into lots of details the term fake news was coined to describe things that were, you know, Russian interference in the election, but it became something else, largely through the instrumentality maybe of President Trump, calling out media. But there have been innumerable stories about things that were just false that media has pursued relentlessly. Consider the young men in the, you know, out on the Washington Mall out there that media descended on them and eviscerated these young men. And I think most people experienced revulsion over that.
Would you agree or disagree that attacking institutions that have served this country well, attacking the Fifth Estate, the media, the news media, and calling it fake news is right out of an authoritarian's playbook?
Well, it depends on what has happened. You have to take the entire set of circumstances together. So if media has departed from its watchdog role in which they keep both sides accountable and exercise a complete independence from party affiliation, if they've abandoned that, then of course the reaction has to be to call that out.
I wasn't planning to talk about this, but you brought it up. So you can blame the media for talking about it now because you brought it up. But I'd like a specific, because, you know, when you attack, we are scrupulous. And we talked about this just before we went on the air, how scrupulous I am about trying to
be fair.
You're
a more fair-minded guy than most.
Everybody has a bias. There's no question about it.
Yep.
But we try very hard here at WFAE and in NPR to be fair. We do make mistakes, no question about it. So I'd like a specific example of where
what NPR has done, or
NPR
WFAE?
Or WFAE in terms of where we are not neutral. I mean, is Pat McCrory neutral? He's on right now. Is he neutral on WBT?
No, I don't think. Pat's a commentator. He's commenting. I don't think he would deny it. And that's been the difference, Mike, is that there is this profession of objectivity on the part of the hard left media take Fox News. It's funny, there's the vicious, almost deranged attacks on the one outlet nationally that is of significant exposure, that has a lot of conservative thought, Fox News. Everybody thinks it ought to cease to exist, yet the entire rest of the media is to the left. Take CNN. I mean, if someone were to tell me that they believe CNN is fair and objective, and Fox News is unfair, and it tells me everything I need to know about them. I'm objective enough to recognize that Fox News has conservative commentators and a conservative tilt to its news. CNN is hard left and will use falsehood in order to advance the cause. To this day, they keep on saying that, you know, you're giving me a hand signal because you want me to wrap it up, and I don't want to get stuck there. So I'll stop. I mean, we'll just go on to the next thing.
Okay, well, that's a whole show. I'll welcome you back, and we can talk about this for a whole hour that has nothing to do with you or with this race.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about healthcare, because it's on a lot of people's minds.
Sure, yeah.
Is healthcare a right or a privilege in America?
Healthcare would be a right if the systems were set up properly in the United States to serve that interest. So I think if you say, is healthcare right, meaning is everybody entitled to healthcare for free, there is nothing for free. Something will have to happen in order to provide it. Somebody has to be paid or they have to be conscripted to do it. So there is no free.
Well, is it acceptable that the United States is the only major country in the industrialized world that does not have a healthcare system that takes care of all of its citizens?
It is not acceptable, and but then you have to diagnose what the problem is. And frankly, the question betrays a bias in itself, Mike. And so, the implicit notion is there must be a government to see to it that that occurs. But the experience of America is the best way to advance standard of life, standard of living, Goods and services provision and to increase have prosperity generally is markets. It works much better. I mean, we see example after example after example of big government socialism, and the people suffer under it. So, to your point,
talking about markets within medicine,
it does work, Mike.
Does it?
Yes,
look at
sir.
Big
let
pharma.
Me,
look me, at the money me, people pay oh, in this country for prescription drugs that they don't pay in any other country in the world.
And there's a bright color difference distinction between me and Dan McCready.
Okay.
What I would tell you is we get a lot of essential things through markets, food, but people who can't afford it are supported by government programs. We get housing. We pay for our housing through markets. It's not provided by government's beneficent hand to everyone, and yet we have a government support for those who can't afford it. Healthcare could work exactly the same way, but we've erected immense and innumerable barriers to competition so that healthcare providers aren't subject to competition. They're protected because the notion is if we make them big or we protect them from competition, like in the Certificate of Need law, that'll be better, but it's not.
So you want to go to Congress, and Republicans in Congress have tried mightily to repeal Obamacare. Even though the Affordable Care Act is based on then-Governor Romney's Massachusetts health care plan, and he's a Republican. So President Trump has advocated repealing the Affordable Care Act and replacing it with something better. Have you seen a plan? Do you have a plan?
There are innumerable changes that need to be made to tear down barriers to competition and protections from competition that exist throughout the medical system. One that we've just done. We just passed legislation, did it with bipartisan support in the General Assembly. The governor allowed it to become law. 31 Democrats voted in favor of it to expand the use of association health plans. That takes employees of small businesses and the self-employed mm-hmm. and lets them pool together to form large group plans, maybe through the realtors, maybe through the Chamber of Commerce, across the country, geographically widespread. And the idea is you move them that way into the large group market, which has always been a market that's functioned better and provided care at a lower cost. And so that's an example. It's one. I would repeal the Certificate of Need law that says you have to have government permission every time you open a hospital bed or provide a new hospice service or provide a new imaging device. Those are things that don't make sense. There are restrictions on competition. I would open up transparency so that consumers can participate meaningfully in the economic decisions involving medical care.
But competition is based on making a profit. Should profit be a part of the ingredients when it comes to people's health care, when it comes to people's health, living and dying?
Profit is what drives the market system, and people can make profits in selling housing, and people can still get housing. People make profits in selling food and growing food, providing it to markets, and there's nothing unseemly about profit. And profit can work just fine. In fact, that's what the magic of the system is. You don't have to extract something involuntarily from one person, say a provider of healthcare, in order to provide the service to someone else. You can have a consensual market transaction in which both parties get what they need. Okay. That's our problem, is we've decided to abandon markets, and the left wants to go farther to that, to take the entire healthcare system and have it governed dominated by government. That's what Dan McCready, as far as anyone can tell, that's what Dan McCready's talking about.
Our immigration system is clearly broken. Neither party seems to want to fix it or be able to fix it. Would you work toward that end, and do you have an idea on how to fix our broken system? And I have 30 seconds here. We can come back and talk about
it. So I agree with the president's priority, which is to secure the border. That has been, border security has been the issue since Ronald Reagan's general amnesty in the 1980s, and it's never been done. And once that problem is solved, you can move on to other problems, but you're not going to get a consensus over that. And just saying we're going to have comprehensive immigration reform is a buzzword for not doing anything.
Dan Bishop, State Senator Dan Bishop, is running in the 9th Congressional District. He's the Republican in the race. We'll come back and talk more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Today we're talking with both of the candidates in the 9th Congressional District. In a moment, we'll meet Democrat Dan McCready again. And right now we're talking to State Senator Dan Bishop, the Republican in the race for the 9th District. We started talking about immigration just before the break. You've said that you've supported the border wall that the president wants to build. How would you characterize the administration's approach toward what's happening with people, refugees, who are crossing the border, where kids are put in cages and separated from their parents.
It's an indication of the problem that is precipitated by not having border security established.
Is that the way to handle it? That's the best we can do?
I don't think there's a good answer to once you have people coming in mass into the country who do not have legitimate asylum claims and no real prospect of them, to bring them in and then deal with it thereafter, you essentially there's no good way to deal with it. You either release them into the country and they don't show up, which is a very common thing, or you have to detain somebody somehow, and then that precipitates that problem. My understanding is that predates the Trump administration, that it was done in the Obama administration. It is an intolerable set of circumstances. We even had problems getting the left, though, to agree to the supplemental appropriation in order to alleviate, ameliorate the problems, the conditions in the detention that existed. So that's why border security is critical.
In the state Senate, you worked to force state sheriffs to cooperate with ICE in those detainer agreements, which are voluntary, and some of the sheriffs around the country, including our own, Gary McFadden, said that sometimes complying with those detainer orders would put him in violation of the law, because there are laws about how long you can hold somebody. So this is a situation where the federal government is asking for help from a local organization, the sheriff's departments. Why can't the federal government handle their own business?
First of all, it's not the same thing as 287G. That's the program I think you described, where there's actually deputized deputies to serve as immigration agents, such as has been the case by agreement, voluntary agreement, by the sheriffs in Mecklenburg County for a long time. It's not what we're talking about. We're talking about basic cooperation with a form of a judicial process or a form of process by Immigration Customs Enforcement. Gary McFadden, there is no binding authority in the United States. There are a couple trial-level decisions out elsewhere. There's no binding authority that says there's anything invalid about an administrative detainer request. Now, you're right, they can't require local authorities to cooperate, but we've had cooperation among law enforcement agencies, local, state, and federal, forever.
In Congress, would you try to make this mandatory?
Absolutely.
Around the country?
Absolutely. Let me put it this way. The Congress cannot do that. We could, in the General Assembly, say we're going to set policy to be, as it's always been in practice, mm-hmm. that local law enforcement agencies, state law enforcement agencies, will cooperate voluntarily with federal immigration authorities, and that's all in the world it does. And the alternative is, as the sheriff, to make his political point, has released now 22 dangerous criminal illegal aliens that ICE detailed in a press release, one of them a child rapist, two-time child rapist or molester, and another one an occasion of repeated domestic abuse. It's an outrageous thing to do, and it is to the detriment of the very community that he proposes to be in favor of.
But didn't he release them because no charges had been brought?
No. He released them because they met the conditions of bond, and he decided not to either give notice to ICE or to honor for their administrative detainer request so that they could pick the person up.
Who
in each case, they're all in the country illegally.
Both you and your opponent oppose a ban on assault weapons, if I'm right about this, despite the alarming rash of mass shootings that we've seen in this country. Neither of you want to ban the types of assault weapons and high-capacity magazines used in El Paso and in Dayton. Why? Why don't you support that ban, and what are you willing to do to move toward ending this senseless violence?
Well, I think you've mischaracterized my position. I haven't said that I oppose any. I have said that it is not. There's no prospect of banning all semi-automatic long guns, if that's what you're describing. But you have to define your term when you say assault weapon. Are there some weapons that need to be prohibited? I don't know. I'm open to considering any of it.
Does the average citizen need an AK-47?
You know, the average citizen has a Second Amendment explicit constitutional right to keep and bear arms. The United States Supreme Court has said that means arms that are in widespread circulation. So here's the thing, Mike. There may be things that need to be done, but you need to know what their effect is going to be and what their purpose is when you say that's what you need to do. So you say we've had this gun violence. You've had a prevalence of guns in America as long as America's been around. You haven't had this spate. You haven't had this type of constant story every week of mass shootings. That's different. I think it's important to know, I mean, you're a smart guy. figure out what's different, as opposed to going and having a reflexive, antagonistic view toward guns and say that's the place you go and solve it.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You've questioned whether background checks would have stopped these mass shootings.
That's right.
Isn't that, though, just another safeguard, a sensible safeguard to have background checks before you buy a firearm?
I appreciate the question. Let me answer the question with a question. If you're going to, if this idea is you're going to now take, you say we're going to have background checks, I think that's sensible, what we already have for background checks. But okay, if you're going to extend that to person-to-person transfers, and that's your first priority and only thing you have on the calendar, isn't that, doesn't that beg the question, why? If you can't point to a single mass shooting and all these mass shootings, this resulted from that loophole, as it's described by some, then why is setting off that loophole the thing to do? Don't you need to solve the problem?
You can't point to a single instance of people trying to vote at the polls illegally, and yet we push for voter ID laws. Experts say constantly that there is no instance of that kind of voter fraud.
Well, I mean, you've changed subjects pretty dramatically, and I'll be glad to debate that on its merits.
It's the same reasoning.
It's not. It's pretty simple to see. I think they're totally different, and it would take a few minutes to get into that issue to explain why. But I do think that the question becomes which is. I mean, is that the if that's the first priority to close that loophole? And I'm not, frankly, that opposed to closing the loophole, but I think the question has to be asked, what is it that you're trying to do? And why don't you have a proposal? What is your proposal that you think would solve the problem? Now, Beto O'Rourke says, I'd like to go and confiscate people's weapons. Let's get it on the table. If that's what people are saying, then folks need to have that debate.
Do you think we're at a tipping point? Do you think that the electorate is at a tipping point? They've had enough of this. They want something to done.
I think people across the board want things to change on that. That's got to change. It's a scourge.
You make a point on your website of talking about your Christian values that help make America great. And one of your advisors, Jim Blaine, told Politico recently that you have embraced Donald Trump 100%. He's coming to campaign for you on September the 9th. His son has been here. Others have been here from the administration. How do you reconcile Christian values with what some people would see as a man who does not embrace any of those values?
Well, everybody's entitled to their view. I would say this. I think people have a misconception about Christianity, maybe, that as a notion that everyone's perfect. That's the opposite of Christianity. Flawed people have done important things and got through in God's work over, I mean, that's the story of the Bible. We're all enormously flawed. I am. And he is. Donald Trump is. Mm-hmm. But he comes to a point in time when, again, by my perspective, there is this confluence of folks who are opposed to it. It's the Democratic Party. I've never seen it farther left. I've never seen the media more in lockstep with the Democratic Party and constantly attacking. And we've even seen the instrumentalities of law enforcement and in the FBI and spy agencies appearing to conduct surveillance on a presidential campaign and then inhibit his progress for 2.5 years thereafter with really nothing to show for it. All those things make it pretty clear that Donald Trump may be the only person in the world that could withstand that kind of a concentrated, coordinated attack, and so he's pursuing ideas that I agree with. That is to say, he's appointed great conservative justices of the Supreme Court of the United States, as he said he would. He's pursued tax cuts, and he's got an economy that Barack Obama said you didn't need a magic wand. He's got an economy that's soaring. Jobs are being created. He's working on border security. Maybe most of all, he responds to those on the left who now say they want to be socialists, and he says that America will never be a socialist country. Those are important things.
What do you hear from farmers in North Carolina about the trade war?
I hear that they're with the president, but they need this to be brought to a successful conclusion soon.
Okay. Dan Bishop, I know you have to go at 9:30. It's 9:30, 1:30, so it's time to go.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you for being here. State Senator Dan Bishop, the Republican candidate in the North Carolina 9th Congressional District. When we have candidates on in the same race in the same program, we strive to give them exactly the same amount of time. But because of the senator's schedule, he had to leave, so you're getting a little extra time, Dan McCready. The remainder of the hour does go to Dan McCready, who's the Democrat, who has been running for 27 months in the 9th Congressional District.
27 months down, 5 days to go.
That's right. Welcome back. You lost the last election by 905 votes. It's a squeaker. You went to Disney World. The results were overturned. If you don't win this time, Will you run again in 2020? Because that race begins September 11th.
The one thing I'm not going to do is I'm not going back to Disney World, because that turns out to be a terrible place to go when you got four little kids and you're trying to relax after a long campaign.
But seriously, you will. Whoever wins on September the 10th, will go to Congress. When do you go to? When does the winner go? Right away.
We're taking a look at that. I imagine that the election's on Tuesday. The results should be canvassed shortly thereafter. I imagine whoever wins will be sworn in pretty much immediately, because there's a lot of work to get done.
And then you're only in office until 2020.
I am not thinking one single minute beyond Tuesday right now.
Inside Elections, the poll, I mentioned this to Dan Bishop, of August 26th, had you ahead 46-42%. That means it's still very, very close, just like it was last time, and within the margin of error. So it's a toss-up. No matter which of you wins, you will be representing, as I told Dan Bishop, an electorate that is equally divided. So will you be able to serve, will you be willing to serve those who did not vote for you?
Absolutely. Let me just make one comment, if I may, on that poll. That was, we think, an overly optimistic poll. We think that this is going to be extremely tight, and this thing is going to come down to hundreds of votes, just like last time.
Okay.
Just so all the listeners know the importance of voting in this race. I believe that no one should go to Washington as a Democrat first or a Republican first. They should go as Americans first. To me, if I have the honor of serving, it would be a point of pride to serve.
But how do you serve people? You just heard the senator's point of view on a lot of these issues, which are diametrically opposed to you, and I would assume diametrically opposed to the people who support you. How do you support the people who support him if you win? They don't agree with anything you agree.
Well, I would do the same thing I've done the last 27 months, which is be present in all communities, include Republicans, Democrats, and independents in my events. We've done more than 25 town halls over the last 2 months in all eight counties in this district. I've gone places where candidates don't normally go, where Democrats don't normally go. Oftentimes, I've been the only Democrat in the room. People feel when you get east of Charlotte, where because of trade deals out of Washington, put in place by both parties, these counties have been economically devastated. Mm-hmm. And so many textile jobs, many other types of jobs are gone. People feel that politicians out of Washington don't do anything for them, and to a large extent, they're right. And I've tried to show people that I will fight for them no matter their background, no matter their political party, just like we did in the Marine Corps, or just like I built a business.
President Trump is coming here on September the 9th on the election eve to campaign to stump for your opponent. Mike Pence's wife has been here for your opponent. Donald Trump Jr. has been here for your opponent. Are you getting the support you need from the National Democratic Party and from prominent Democrats?
Well, this has never been a race about, inside D.C. politics. Dan Bishop's obviously terrified. He won't run on his agenda because his agenda includes taking health care away from people, gutting public school funding, and going to extreme partisanship, which is a problem in this country. So he's bringing in, everybody and their mom to come bail him out. This has always been about people in North Carolina. And we're going to continue doing these next 5 days exactly what we've done, which is to be out all across this district talking with voters.
But you didn't give me the answer.
What was your question?
Are you getting support from prominent Democrats and the National Democratic Party? And if not,
well,
why not?
I haven't asked for support from prominent Democrats.
Well, why not?
This is a race about North Carolina. This is, I think a lot of pundits want to make this all about, this and that out of Washington and Democratic Party and Republican Party. This is about, our message is, we're going to bring this country together. We're going to rise above this broken partisanship. I think we have a completely broken Washington, a completely broken D.C. It is a swamp, and nothing's getting done up there, and we're not going to fix that until we get leaders who believe in fighting for everyone and working across the aisle.
So you said you want to go to Washington to put country over politics, which is an admirable idea, and I think one that we thought most people in Congress did, at least for the longest amount of time. I'm not sure that was ever true, but it's certainly not true now. Mm-hmm. Because it's all about money, and it's all about staying in office, and it's about raising enough money to stay in office. And also because the system is set up where you, as the Democrat, have to play to your base, and your opponent, as a Republican, has to play to his. The vast people in the middle get left out of all of this, and it's destroying the country, and it's destroying our system. So do you really think that you can go to Washington as a Democrat and put country over party and not toe the line that Nancy Pelosi and others tell you to toe as a freshman congressman? Or are you just kidding yourself?
Well, we'll take a look at how I've run this campaign. I think people that have followed this would see that, first of all, the problem you identified, that our country is divided politically, that the Republicans and Democrats get up to Washington and people, it becomes not about serving the people, it becomes about serving themselves. It becomes about serving the special interests, about serving their own parties. That is why I'm running. That is the problem I want to solve. How we're doing it is we are running a campaign about bringing people together. Our message, as you point out, since the beginning has been about putting country over party. We have, this is a campaign that where we say we can move past that broken partisan politics. We can reach across the aisle to take on the real issues that are affecting people's lives, like healthcare costs that are crushing.
But if you don't toe the party line, they will not give you any power. So how does a freshman congressman accomplish
that? If we win this race, I'll have...
With the smart option, given the fact that if you win this race, you have to start running again right now. So would it not be smarter to keep your head down and toe the party line, or do you think it's smarter to stand out like the so-called squad stands out?
Look, I can only do what I believe and what my values are, which is to serve everyone in this district and be an independent voice for this district. If I have the honor of serving, that's not going to change. And actually, as a Democrat in a very red district like this, I will have a great amount of leverage for this district because, number one, we will have pulled off an amazing victory that the whole country will see, that we can run on a message of bringing this country together. But number two, we haven't had – right now we have no representative because of the cheating perpetrated by my prior opponent, leaving the people without representation in Congress for the better part of a year. Even before that, we had a representative who didn't even believe in fighting for the federal funds that we deserve for this district. We're a donor district. We are sending more tax dollars to Washington than we're getting back. Dan Bishop is blocking Medicaid expansion, paid for with our federal tax dollars. He's sending those tax dollars to other states. We need a fighter in Washington to get those federal funds. It ought to be 50 cents on the dollar for light rail, transportation, infrastructure. You know, where's our community college funding? Not just Charlotte, but all these eastern these counties in eastern North Carolina. Where's our disaster relief funding? It's stuck in red tape. People are getting the short end of the stick because we don't have someone fighting for us. There's nothing partisan in any of that.
Dan McCready is the Democrat running in the 9th Congressional District, which early voting is underway. The election day is September the 10th. It's coming right around the corner. When we come back, we'll talk about health care and some of the things we talked with your opponent about as well, among other things. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to the two candidates in the 9th Congressional District. We spoke with Republican Dan Bishop earlier. Right now, we're talking to Democrat Dan McCready. Before we move on to other topics, you have dismissed some of the, quote, these are your words, crazy aspirational things that some of the Democratic presidential candidates have called for. You think that's wise to say that? And if so, what are those crazy aspirational things?
But again, I'm this is not a career for me. This is a calling to serve, much like I felt after 9/11 before joining the Marine Corps. And so I just say what I believe and I do what I believe. And
so what are they? What's crazy and aspirational?
Well, these ideas, you know, so let's talk about building clean energy. I've got more experience in this than I think anyone in the Congress. I started a company with another Marine that helped build 36 solar farms across North Carolina, put 700 North Carolinians to work, and made our state number two in the country in solar power right now. I played a leading role in that. I know how to build clean energy. This Green New Deal is not something that is the best way to build clean energy.
They spent 7 hours on CNN talking to every single Democratic presidential candidate yesterday exclusively about climate change. And solar kept coming up. Clean energy kept coming up. Electric cars kept coming up. Phasing out coal immediately kept coming up. Crazy and aspirational, all those things?
Well, so if I have the honor of serving, I'm passionate about clean energy. And by the way, it's worth pointing out that what's happening to our climate is a moral imperative that is, I think, God calls all of us to be stewards.
Those candidates said it was the number one issue, period. Most important issue. Everything else hinges on it.
And by the way, I'm just going to throw out, I know you got a lot of questions, but I do want to throw out, conserving our planet is a conservative principle.
Okay. Do you agree that that's the number one issue facing the world and the country?
Well, I think the number one issue right now in the lives of people in this district are healthcare costs. But protecting our planet right. is a moral imperative. And what I want to do is, if I make it there, I want to use the model of how I've helped create clean energy jobs and build out clean energy in North Carolina as a model nationally. I want to take us from the 30,000 clean energy jobs we have to 100,000. But you've got to make the case based on this is good business, these are good deals, this is good for our state, this is good jobs, so that you can work with both sides to do it. I know how to do that. I did that here. Mm-hmm. And we can use the work we've done here. We're number two in the country in solar power. It's amazing. And I want to take that experience and do that nationally. But you've got to do it in a way that both Republicans and Democrats can get behind.
If the number one issue in your mind, locally at least, is health care, let's talk about that, because health care has been under discussion now for a decade.
Yeah.
You have released what you describe as a comprehensive health care plan with 7 common sense nonpartisan initiatives, these are your words, which would protect people with pre-existing conditions, stand up to Big Pharma and lower drug prices, and expand Medicaid and much more. Since the Affordable Care Act is still in place, why do we need this?
Oh my gosh, healthcare costs are crushing the budgets of North Carolina families. I could tell you so many stories. Most rooms I'm in, we just did, I think, 10 town halls on healthcare. Most rooms I'm in east of Charlotte, where I talked about how the counties have been so devastated economically, most people, if I say, show of hands, how many of you are worried you might get hit with hundreds of dollars out of pocket this month to pay for prescription drugs and healthcare costs, and you don't know how you pay for it? Most hands would go up. Mm. People tell me, my gosh, I was with a veteran the other day out in Robeson County. He's got PTSD. He needs treatment. He's stuck in red tape at the VA. I was with someone who's not even sending their kids to the doctor because they can't afford it.
So your 7 common sense nonpartisan initiatives are nonpartisan. How many Republicans agree with them?
Well, if I have the honor of serving, I hope to get a lot of Republican support and get as many of these as I can, as well as other good ideas through the Congress to lower healthcare costs.
Are those 7 common sense nonpartisan initiatives on your website?
Yeah, you can go to danmccready.com and click on issues. And at the top of the issues page is my healthcare plan. I've also got 2 other plans. There's a prescription drug plan.
Yes, you have a 10-point plan to lower prescription drug prices. One of those points includes stopping foreign countries from taking advantage of
yes.
us. How are they taking? Who and how are they taking advantage of?
It's a great question, and a lot of people don't know this, but we pay more in this country for prescription drugs than anyone else.
Yes.
The reason is our government is about the only one that doesn't negotiate directly.
So how are foreign countries taking advantage of us? It's our government taking advantage of us.
Well, so what happens is, because the big drug companies can charge whatever they want here, basically, and other countries don't let that happen, consumers of drugs in America are paying for the research and development of new drugs for the entire world.
Yes.
So a number of the initiatives in my prescription drug plan seek to lower the cost of drugs here while getting other countries to pay their fair share.
Okay.
I'm happy to talk more about that. I'm really proud of these plans.
I'm not sure how that a fair share is. I mean, if you're going to if I go to the 7-Eleven and they charge me a nickel for a Coke and they charge you $1.50, am I taking advantage of you or the 7-Eleven? I don't think so. I'm just taking what you're. I'm just paying what I'm told to pay.
Well, this goes to the all the big drug company lobbyists up in D.C.
Yeah.
The only reason Medicare is not negotiating right now with the big drug companies to lower drug prices is because of those lobbyists spending tens of million dollars a year and bankrolling people like Dan Bishop. Dan Bishop took the only – I heard him saying on here, I think, a few minutes ago that he didn't believe access to health care was a right. Well, take a look at his votes. He took the only vote from either party against pharmacists being able to tell people about lower-cost drugs.
I asked him, do you think health care in America is a right or a privilege? What do you think?
Access to affordable and quality healthcare is a right, and we need to be fighting for it, and we need to get it.
And he believes that markets come into play when it comes to healthcare. Do you?
He believes
that the profit motive is okay in healthcare.
Well, look, take a look at his votes, because he's shown us what he will do if he goes to Washington, and he will rip away health coverage from people here that are struggling. He's keeping 200,000 North Carolinians right now without health care coverage, by sending our tax dollars to other states by blocking Medicaid expansion. He took one of 10 votes to let insurance companies hike prices on life-saving cancer treatments. When he did vote, it was for a sham health care plan that let insurance companies refuse to pay for your medication if you get sick. If you got heart disease under Dan Bishop's plan, they don't even have to pay for your heart medication. It's crazy. It's only the kind of thing that happens when you're bought and sold by the big pharma companies.
Well, let's talk about something else here. One of your proposals is to strengthen public schools by paying teachers their worth, reducing class sizes, funding early childhood education, and alternatives to four-year colleges. How involved does Congress and the federal government get in all this? This sounds like you're running for school board or state legislature.
Well, this is another thing that a lot of people don't know, but the federal government actually has a really important role to play in our local schools. It provides, for example, critical funding for students with disabilities and low-income students. It needs to be providing a lot more funding for our community colleges, especially in the rural parts of this district, to close a skills gap and help create more good-paying jobs. But as I mentioned earlier, we don't have a representative actually fighting for our fair share of federal funds. The broader point I would make on this, Mike, is people like Dan Bishop, and I would put Betsy DeVos in this camp, I honestly don't think they believe in public schools. I think that their goal, and if you look at Dan Bishop's votes to take away money from Charlotte-Mecklenburg Public Schools, his votes to keep teachers paid less than almost $10,000 less than the national average, such that teachers are going to South Carolina and leaving our state for better opportunities. They want to take money out of public schools and they want to put it in private schools. That's wrong. Every kid in this state, every kid deserves a chance to go to a great public school, regardless of their zip code.
Let's talk about immigration. You may have heard that your opponent's supporter-in-chief, Donald Trump, says you favor open borders and sanctuary cities. I'm quoting his tweets. Where do you stand on immigration?
That was rated false, by the way, by the ratings checkers,
where
which is probably
stand?
No surprise to the readers. Look, I think that Dan Bishop likes to point a lot of fingers at law enforcement. He likes to attack law enforcement, which I think puts people at risk. I think the problem rests with the Congress. Americans have known. This is probably the issue, Mike, more than any other, where Americans have known for decades what to do. The answer is obvious. We need a bipartisan and we need a comprehensive immigration reform. The Congress is the one that won't get it done. Because of their failure to act, we're suffering the consequences here in North Carolina.
So what do you do? I think the president is right when he says that we have an untenable number of people streaming across our southern border. They're refugees. They're fleeing horrible conditions in Guatemala and other places in Central America. But what do you do about that? You just don't fling open the doors and say, come on in, go anywhere you want to. What do you do?
Well, there's a lot to be done. This is why I talk about a comprehensive reform, because I think it's very difficult in the area of immigration to sort of piecemeal it and pick one part of the problem. And just it's all broken. It has to be fixed together. At the end of the day, and we can talk a lot about specific policies, for example, partnering economically with Central American countries to reduce the migration, and you know, securing our border, becoming a nation of laws that are respected again in the area of immigration, upholding our values, not ripping these kids away from their moms at the border, not putting kids in cages. I mean, we can talk about all these policies. At the end of the day, though, I think it comes down to this. The Republicans and Democrats will not sit down and will not do a deal. In the business world, you go in to do a deal, you say, okay, here's the 10 things I want to get done. And you sit down, you and me. If I get 7 of those things, that's pretty good. And that's how we've got to fix immigration. The Democrats can't get everything that they want. The Republicans can't get everything.
But the way the system is set up, the political system in the United States right now, if you do that, if you give things away in the process of negotiation, you will be primaried out of a job.
Well, you know, I'm not saying it's the normal course. It's certainly not the normal course for political leaders to actually do what's right and actually compromise and actually want to work together. Mm-hmm. That's what this campaign's about. And if we win this election on Tuesday, Mike, it will be a signal across the country that we can have a different kind of politics and we can bring people together.
So let me ask you the same question I asked your opponent. You both oppose a ban. He denied this, but you both oppose a ban on assault weapons, despite the alarming rash of mass shootings in this country. Neither of you agree with banning the types of assault weapons that were used in El Paso and Dayton, I think. Same question I asked your opponent. Why? Why don't you support that? And what are you willing to do to help end this violence?
Yeah. Well, let me clarify a bit. What I've said on the issue of assault weapons, well, first of all, let me say I understand these weapons. I carried them for 4 years.
Yeah.
I understand the seriousness that comes with them, the responsibility that comes with them. But I'm also a person of faith, and I'm a dad of four little kids. And these tragic shootings, every time these happen, my wife Laura and I are worried about the safety of all of our kids.
I asked Dan Bishop, does any, and I'm going to ask you the same question, does any civilian have any need to carry a weapon of war, an AK-47? And he said the Second Amendment doesn't describe what kind, I'm paraphrasing, it doesn't describe what kind of weapons.
If you're walking around with the AK-47, you got some bigger issues. If you're hunting a deer with one of these AR-15s, you got issues. I mean, there's a lot to be done on the problem of gun violence, a lot to be done. The problem right now is not that we don't have ideas. The problem is, again, that they're doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Everything, the U.S. House passed a background checks bill last year that would apply to assault weapons. It gets over to the Senate, and it's dead on arrival with Mitch McConnell. This is why I've called for closing the gun show loophole, closing the online sales loophole, comprehensive background checks, red flag laws. The reason I focused here, I mean, there's a lot of things to look at and the conversations had. The reason I focus here is I think these are things we actually can get done.
So the red flag laws, which allow people to alert or maybe remove guns from people that they think or the police think would be that those folks would be harmful to themselves or others. That's a red flag law. You talk about background checks. I think most people want background checks in America. But a lot of people on the other side of this question fear that any attempt to do anything with regard to their guns is an attempt to remove the Second Amendment. So how do you allay their fears?
We absolutely can protect and defend the Second Amendment at the same time that we have comprehensive background checks. If you look at in my case, I got a little pump-action shotgun at Cabela's last year. I went through a background check. It was pretty quick and pretty easy. I'm a law-abiding citizen, a former Marine. But these white nationalist guys can just go into a gun show right now and get all the weapons they want with no background check. 90% of Americans support background check. Most NRA members support them. Okay. It's just these career politicians that are blocking it.
I have 2 minutes left, and I want to do two topics. So very quickly, taxes. We've already had a tax cut, allegedly. You want to lower taxes on the middle class, and yet the deficits keep rising. How can you do that?
Well, to address the deficits, which are a huge problem, I believe that we need a constitutional amendment to balance the budget. When I started a small business, I made payroll every single year. I balanced my budget every single year. I think it is
crazy.
But
the government is not a business.
Which is why we need this constitutional amendment, because they should be forced outside of situations of war.
I've had economists say that's a very unwise thing, that the government needs flexibility.
No, you need to leave – well, you do need to leave flexibility in the case of great economic distress, like a depression or a great recession or a case of war.
So if you have a constitutional amendment, then you don't have that tool anymore.
Well, I would write the amendment to – have an exception in these kinds of cases.
Okay, so you have said that you will fight for term limits in Congress. You believe the military's up-and-out system, if you're not moving up, it's time to go home, is what should be there, the same standard. How many terms is enough? Quickly.
Well, I think it needs to be an up-or-out standard. So rather than
if you're moving from freshman congressman to Speaker of the House and it's taken you 7 years or seven terms to get there, that's okay.
Because look at what we got now is we got all these people. It's not 7 years, Mike. It's like 30 years.
Okay, how many terms? Because I'm running out of time. How many terms is enough?
Well, I think you need an up-or-out system. The problem is people who hang around for 20 or 30 years to go be a subcommittee chair, right, and they don't actually get anything done.
So
I'm interested
terms,
in getting some
How many
done
terms is enough?
Well, again, I don't think you set it as a number of terms. I think you set it – like in the military, if you're leading, if you're doing a good job, there's only so many – I'm saying that we got to wrap.
That's it. We're done, man. Right. We're out of time. Dan McCready, the Democratic candidate in the 9th Congressional District, thank you for your time and for Dan Bishop's. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.